talk about a really interesting adaptive beamforming system that they've been building. So this is a nice, a very real application of some of the things we've talked about this semester in class. Jeff Carter is going to begin. Jeff, make sure as you, if other people speak, they introduce themselves.
Thanks, Jeff.
Welcome.
Like Dr. Kelly said, I'm Jeff Carter from Radiance Technologies. I'm going to start off trying to give a high-level overview of a quick overview of Radiance, and then talk a little bit about our system in general. Then I'm going to turn it over to Chad Williams, who's going to give some more details about the model behind what we do in our locks, and then he'll turn it over to Gerald Godbald, who's going to talk about some variants of what we do with the system. We're located in Oxford, Mississippi. Our headquarters are in Huntsville, Alabama, and we have offices all over the United States, in Korea, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And the core of what we do in Oxford is sensing systems and signal processing type of work. We do, the company as a whole does a wide variety of things. Infrared systems and robots, things like that. But what we focus on at Oxford is signal processing type stuff. A couple of products that we do work on in Oxford. We have the Falcon radar system, which is a frequency agile radar system that can be used in a number of different situations for a number of different applications. It's small, cheap, lightweight, and can be, like I said, easily adaptable depending on what the user needs.
We also Jeff, what does frequency agile mean? You explain that.
It can change frequency as it needs. It's not fixed on a specific frequency. And actually, you give it a band of frequencies and it hops around. There's a frequency hopping type scheme to help prevent jamming and to reduce false alarm rates and clutter, increase clutter rejection. And clutter and radar is things that you don't want to see, like trees. You know, you're interested in cars and people moving. You don't care about the trees and stuff. So by doing this frequency agile, frequency hopping scheme, we can reduce a lot of that type of stuff. We also have a group that does electromagnetic simulation technologies. They're part of our group. We've got two guys in Oxford, and we also have two guys in Chattanooga, Tennessee that work on the same problem. And we're in the process of upgrading this to this technology to operate on a large scale multi-core computer with several hundred nodes to do large scale antenna design and then actually take that simulation and then we can produce the actual antenna in Oxford or other electromagnetic systems. One thing that Gerald's going to touch on is talking about taking the signal processing that we do with the acoustics and some other things and distribute that over a large scale processor, a multi-node type processor. We also have a sonar system, the upward looking sonar that we're building in Oxford. That actually sits on the ocean floor and pings upward and looks for ships going by or submarines going by. And it's kind of neat the way it works. If it actually detects a loitering vehicle, this bottom part is a weight. It releases from the weight close to the surface and sends a signal back to a satellite or to a land-based radio and says, hey, you guys need to come look here. There's somebody here that's not supposed to be here. So most of the time it sits on the bottom of the ocean floor. So that's a pretty cool product. What we're here to talk about today, though, is the pack rack, which is this system. This is an older version, but it's basically the same thing that's sitting over there. Pack rack stands for passive acoustic ranging and tracking. And it's a system that it started out as a multimodal system that used a variety of sensors to detect a variety of things. What we focused in on is using that to specifically detect gunshots from snipers, basically. And we've been doing that. Let me go on with my slide. The system works either currently in bang only mode or flash bang mode, which I'll talk about in the next slide. It's man portable. A single man can carry that and take it with him if he needs to. Works on either AC or DC power. Can work stationary on a tripod, or as you saw in the last slide, can sit on the back of a Humvee and drive around. Communicates either with wireless LAN, wired LAN, or a data type radio. And system can operate standalone there as it sits, or can be networked together with a number of other sensors, not necessarily acoustic sensors, to work as a group. So.
But when you network them together, the beamformer part works each unit works independently. You're not actually.
Just to clarify, we're not actually doing beamforming as is traditional, and Chad's going to talk about that a little more. But yes, each box works independently, and then there's another computer somewhere that fuses all that data, takes it all in, and says, okay, what makes the most sense? This box says it's this direction, this box says it's this direction. Okay, this means it's probably here. And we'll talk a little bit more about the hardware in detail later, but each system has its own GPS unit that not only gives us location information, but gives us very accurate timing information, which is one of the ways we predict where the shooter is based on accurate timing of each individual box and accurate location. We're not the only ones out there doing this. We've got some competition, and these are some of the ones that are out trying to do the same thing we're doing now. All the systems work. They all basically do the same thing, but they all work a little differently. And we've done head-to-head testing with several of these other companies, and each time we pretty much outperform them in every possible scenario. So, I guess. We're proud of what we've done, and it seems to work really well compared to some of these other companies that have been doing it longer than we have. Okay, kind of the acoustics of a gunshot. Systems can detect gunshots in four different ways. You can have a bang-only solution, which I'm about to talk about. You can have a crack-only solution, crack bang or flash bang. The bang, when you're talking about a weapon fire, is the bang from when you shoot the gun, from the gunpowder exploding in the rifle. The crack, when I talk about crack, is a bullet traveling at supersonic speed, and as it passes by, it breaks the speed of sound, and that wave front, where it's breaking the speed of sound, is a crack. And then the last slide I'll talk about flash, and that's the actual flash when you fire a rifle. There's that flash that comes out of the end of the barrel. So, for a bang-only solution, system listens for the muzzle blast from the detonation of the gunpowder. A single sensor array, or that system, with a bang-only solution can only provide a bearing to target with accurate, and in our case extremely accurate, azimuth and elevation information. But it cannot tell you with a bang-only solution how far the target is. We can only give you a direction. Multiple sensors, multiple units, like our MACRAT system, which Gerald's going to talk about, can provide accurate geolocation, range to target, range to shooter information. This system works as long as the shooter is generally within the acoustic range of the array. Basically, if the array can't hear it, it can't tell you where the shooter is. So, this system as it stands, though, is prone generally to a high number of false alarms. Other things sound like gunshots, and there's no other information other than that bang sound that it can use to key off of to eliminate false alarms. For example, a door slamming on a truck or a car backfiring, all of those things sound generally like gunshot. But with the system as we have, we generally always pick up the gunshot. As long as we can hear it, we're going to report it. So part of the work we're doing is filtering out what's really gunshot and what's not, and that's kind of the next step where we're headed right now. All right, in a bang only solution, this is kind of a little cartoon, but you can see the bang, the acoustic wave from the bang passing over the sensor, and like I said, that gives us accurate azimuth and elevation information to the shooter, but we don't know how far away he was. We have no point of reference. Crack-only solution, which some of the competition does, but is generally not done a lot because it's not very accurate. But it listens for the crack of the shock wave as it passes over the array. Problem with that is, in order to hear the shockwave, the bullet has to pass within a very close proximity of the array. Basically, you have to be shot at. And if you're far enough away where the projectile has slowed down below the speed of sound, it's no longer going to produce that shockwave, and it won't detect it either. So there are lots of deficiencies. Provides reasonably accurate bearing to the shooter and limited range information, but it's not always accurate. And the way the shock as the projectile travels, the shock wave starts out as a very narrow cone, and then as it slows down, it widens. And the people that use this type of of technology to detect bullets, which we don't do, they try to measure the angle of that cone to predict direction and range, and it's not always very accurate because it's not always the same type of bullet. There are lots of variables that go in there. So, and I think we saw some numbers from somebody that was like plus and minus 20% on range, and so not a very good option. You can see here as the projectile moves, that wave front starts to flatten out, and it. By passing over the array, it measures the angle of that wave front. Crack bang solution, which is what also the competition does, and we're looking at adding that into what we're doing. Currently, we don't do that. But it listens for the muzzle blast, detonation of the gunpowder, and the crack from the projectile passing by the array. This can provide more accurate range to the shooter because they make some assumptions as to how fast the projectile is moving based on that wave front, and knowing the time the projectile passed and the time the bang arrives from the gun, they can estimate fairly reasonably how far away the target is, and they also get good azimuth and elevation information. Because they trigger off of the crack and then they wait for the bang, there are a low number of false positives. But there are a low number of actual true positives because the bullet, once again, has to pass near the array. You have to be shooting at the array. And here in another cartoon, you can see the projectile passing over the array, followed by the boom from the gun. And knowing the difference in the two, you can estimate the range.
Jeff, can you give us some sense of the distances involved? So how far do these bullets typically travel? The rays usually on the perimeter, let's say, of an installation, and the sniper shooting into the installation. So what sort of, certainly at the end of the trajectory, the bullet's probably subsonic. But you know,
probably, but the other issue is, like most pistols, are not going to be supersonic. So it won't detect a pistol firing. As it exits the muzzle, yeah, it's probably going to be supersonic, but very quickly it falls off. But the idea is to place these around the perimeter of an installation, whether it be, you know, a camp in Iraq or a nuclear weapons installation, and detect people shooting in. So, and because of the issue with the crack not necessarily always being there, That's why we haven't focused on that yet. We focused on the boom. That's generally always going to be there. So, now what we've done is we've taken our system and mated it with a system that is built in Huntsville. That's an infrared sniper detection system. And with infrared, once again, you get a very accurate azimuth and elevation to target, as do we, but you don't get any time information either. So by combining the two units, you see pretty much instantaneously the flash of the rifle being shot or the gun being shot, and knowing the time between that flash and the time we hear the boom, we can provide, with the combination of the two systems, very accurate range information. Usually within, we've been getting 1-2% of the range, right?
Yeah, we probably shouldn't talk about that, but...
Yeah, so... anyway, like I said, we've got Kusig and IR systems providing very accurate information. And this is this is the flash from the gun, which actually would move much faster. My animation skills are lacking. So. And then followed by the boom, and knowing the time difference between the flash and the bang, get accurate range and range information. I think that's it for me. It is. I'll turn it over to Chad.
I have a problem. Do you detect multiple targets or just a single target system?
We can do multiple targets.
And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. Again, my name is Chad Williams. I also work at Gradients Technologies. And I'm enduring Dr. Piconi's wrath in this course just like the rest of you. So, as he put it earlier, education by the pound with the amount of material that he's covering. Okay, I just want to talk to you very briefly, and unfortunately I can't get into low-level details of what we do because it is a government contract and we're restricted on the details we can talk about. But I'm going to very briefly talk to you about how we model the acoustic signals that we're dealing with. We go about this in a little bit different approach than I guess would be the standard approach of beamforming. We're actually crazy enough to think that we can do in real time a nonlinear optimization algorithm. And we're probably the only people in the world crazy enough to attempt that, but so far it's working really well for us. So, all of you know with optimization, you have a model that you're trying to match to data, right? So this is how we set up our model. We'll assume with this drawing here that we have an acoustic source at some location, and although it's not drawn to scale here, it's a far-field source, okay? So we can assume that we have a plane wave, acoustic plane wave traveling across our array, all right? And we have an array, like you see here, of microphones. And we represent that by piece of I, okay? And that's an arbitrary microphone location relative to the origin. And then we have several angles here that I want to define with phi and theta, which are our declination angle and our azimuthal angle relative to our reference frame. And then also piece of IM, which is the angle between our velocity vector of the plane wave traveling and the vector that locates the microphone in space, okay? Now, we assume that we can have multiple sources present, although I haven't drawn them, okay? And so I'm gonna say that my model of the pressure at this microphone is just simply our time series pressure, simply M sub I. I should have made these fonts larger, and I apologize. It's just the superposition of the time series of these multiple sources, okay? So it's just a summation over source 1 to M, how many other sources you have present, at some time minus, or some T minus tau sub I M. And I'm going to say that tau sub I M is the time of arrival delay between the microphone and the origin for the source. So it would be the time difference that it takes for this plane wave to hit this microphone and then hit the origin, okay? So it's just that time delay. And that's what I've defined here. It's just the projection
of the velocity vector onto the position vector normalized by the speed of sound squared. Okay? Go ahead, Dr. Cohn.
I have lots of questions, of course. So, shouldn't there be at least an attenuation factor on those sources, or also perhaps a linear filtering? Are you going to get to that? Or
there's no attenuation because we're in the far field, and our largest travel distance is here.
But attenuation from...
We're not assuming anything about SPL.
Okay.
Okay, that's not... All that we're wanting to get out of this model is a bearing and a timestamp.
So you don't care how the signal was modified from where it was actually or originated?
No, we don't.
Okay.
That might be something we could add into a model later for classification aspects. If once we actually knew a position in the range, we could back out atmospheric absorption and other effects that would modify or filter the signals it propagates, and we might be able to get some more fidelity in a classifier. But as you know, because we've already spoken about it, we're not really focusing on classification yet. Right now, the primary job of that array, as it stands by itself, is to point toward where a sound came from, or multiple sounds, and give a very accurate timestamp as to when that sound hit the array.
But I guess because the array is physically small, you don't have to worry about how this wave changes from sensor to sensor due to the linear filter.
Right.
You could say
we can assume that essentially the signal right here that we see at this microphone, or let's look over here, the signal that we see from the source emanating on that side of the room at this microphone, since we're in the far field, is essentially the same signal that we see right here, just delayed by some time. Okay. Let's see. Again, the velocity vector for the source is just simply defined as the pointing vector as it travels, scaled by the speed of sound. Okay, that's why I call it a velocity vector. Okay. Then we can simply just take this and we can transform it into the frequency domain. And basically, this time series becomes a source spectrum, if you want to think of it that way, and for each source, and then phasing information associated with each source. Okay. And then I'm going to essentially take this exponential component and just define it. I did a really bad job here because I know you can't read these, but I'm just going to basically define a phasing matrix for each source, okay? Now what we're doing here, we call it a blind source separator, and if you do a Google that or any kind of literature search, there's lots of people that work on blind source separation techniques. But we're claiming that it's an optimal nonlinear least squares solution to direction of arrival problems. And this is actually something that I guess we've personally been working on, not just at Radiance, but at a previous job for going on 5 or 6 years now. essentially, we take that model that we just at a high level went over and plug it into a nonlinear least square solver. We personally implemented two different optimization algorithms. First that we tried was the Lindbergh-Marquardt method, which if you're familiar with, is a trust region method, and it works fine. As you're well aware, probably it is only dependent on first derivative information for your sensitivities, on the directions that you move for your iterations. Then we implemented a full-blown Newton method, which is a true second-order method, or second derivative method, and it takes into account curvature information for your objective function. And although this works faster. Now, it's much more tedious to implement because you have to calculate all these second derivative sensitivities, which are all listed down here. Lindbergh-Marquardt only depends on these first two. Then we have to, by hand, go in and calculate all these sensitivities which is tedious. It's not that hard, but it's tedious, but you can imagine how easy it would be to make a mistake in coding this up. And then plus, we're trying to make it work in real time, so you have to be super careful about memory management and not repeating calculations and being very efficient in how you do these calculations. But because we've got the curvature information that we're throwing into to predict where to go to with our next iteration, it converges much more quickly. And since we have an objective function where we can calculate those sensitivities, we went ahead and went to the trouble to do that, and it paid off for us in the end. Our residual, and I kind of skipped ahead of myself, I apologize. The residual is simply our measurements M. M is our measurement. That's what we measure at the microphones, okay? Minus our where we predict the sounds are coming from, which is the information that's held in this E matrix, and our source vector, okay? Now, we can show, fortunately I can't show here, but we can show that the optimal source vector, given the measurements, and given where we're predicting that it's coming from, can be solved with this it's basically an AX equal B problem, okay? So it's a linear least squares fit, essentially. So we optimize the spectra from where we think they are. We make an estimate. Okay, we have a source here. We have a source here. Given our measurements, this is our best spectra. Okay, and we iterate on that until we come up with a correct solution, or until the algorithm converges. Our objective function that we're trying to minimize, we're just trying to minimize the residual. We're trying to match the data as well as we can based on our model. Okay, so we're just minimizing the magnitude of the residual. Okay, we're driving this to match that. And that's pretty much, other than working out the details of the mathematics and plugging in the right equations, it's really that simple.
So can you go back
sure.
to the previous slide where you defined E? So what are the parameters that you're varying?
The parameters that vary, okay, are how many sources do we think are present? That's an unknown. And what are the directions to them? So we have an azimuth and an elevation for each source. So there's three parameters two free parameters per source, but the number of sources is a free parameter. Does that make sense?
Right.
So those are the things we're optimizing on. The directions and how many sources are present. Does that answer your question?
And so then can you go to the next slide, please? So do you optimize, you essentially search for the values of this matrix, or do you actually have to compute the exponential terms every iteration?
Let me think how this works in the code.
You know, I see an e to the something, which makes it sort of additionally nonlinear, you could say. But I'm thinking that sort of table lookup, or that's not a serious.
No, it's not. It's not. You pick a direction, okay? You pick a theta and a phi for each source, and you calculate your e that's associated with that theta and phi, because that changes your that changes
you
your
have
e.
To calculate that
you do have to calculate it each iteration, because when your theta and phi change, your phasing information for the sound crossing the array changes, and that's all that e holds is direction information about how the signal is phased on these microphones.
Okay. You can't just call that a constant and find that constant. You actually have to do the computation.
You actually have to do the computation.
So when you say the works versus works faster, can you give us some idea in terms of like O of N or some,
I'll tell you, I've done flop count calculations, but I don't have them here. Well, I haven't done them for the Ludenberg Marquardt. I've done them for the Newton method. But just from a practical point of view, with the Ludenberg Marquardt on similar processing hardware, we can do about two sources, or we can solve for up to two sources, whereas with the Newton algorithm, we can do up to five in the same amount of time, turnover time, for a real-time operation. So it's probably about a factor of 2.5 times faster.
So when you measure real time, that's that's from the time the wave hits the array to the time you produce a solution.
That's the time we have processing hardware here, and we're data acquisition hardware, and we're collecting signals from all six microphones. And so we take a window of data. We feed that window of data into the processor. We crunch on it, spit out answers, and we have to return back, turn the loop, before we collect more data than is a window length.
And the window length is how long?
I have it in the later slide, but we're doing it at about 13 times a second. So, 13 hertz turnover, essentially.
It's interesting because that's actually a pretty long time for the amount of data points that you have. You're spending a fair amount of computation per sample point.
It's very intensive, yeah. Computational. That's why I say that we're probably the only people in the world crazy enough to do for DOA estimation to do a nonlinear optimization routine. But there are things that we gain.
Right.
I was
trying to get some sense of how that compares to other DSP applications. So, for example, in the same amount of time, on the same amount of hardware, we could do a complete speech recognition task, which is as we sort of alluded to in class, a millions of parameter model and pretty complicated. But but that involves more data. You're doing a lot of computation for one window of data, which is fairly small amount.
Yeah, it's very short. I think it's 256 points in time, but it's per mark. But that's that much data for each microphone. So 6 times 256.
So the Newton method, I think, it can't be worse than O of n squared.
I don't remember.
I think, but it sounds like you're on the verge of somewhere between O of n squared and O of n cubed.
Garth, well, you've met Garth. He's done a lot of work in making it fast. He's worked on this for, like I said, several years, and this is kind of the best point at which he's gotten it to. And he's kind of to the point where the effort that he has to put into it is probably not worth the return that he gets back from it, and in a sense of being cost effective. Yeah, I know you're very familiar with those kinds of things.
So all the computations are floating point.
Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit about the numerical sensitivity of these derivatives, which usually are pretty sensitive?
Right now, I know when he was doing tests, he was carrying things out to maybe the 12th or 14th decimal place.
13th decimal place.
Yes.
To verify that things were operating properly. So yes, it's very sensitive. Now, like I stated earlier, one of the free parameters is how many sources are present. It's a blind source separator. We go into it not knowing how many sources are present. And you're probably familiar with the Keiki information criterion. This is just a simple tool that we can use to determine how many sources are present. Essentially, if you drew a plot, basically what we have to do, because we're going into it as blind, at least initially, is we have to assume one source in our model, or maybe we'll start off assuming two, okay? And you'll come up with a solution, you'll have a residual, right? Some magnitude of the objective function. So if we solve for two and we have a residual left over, then we solve for three, and it's going to get better by some amount. It's always going to get better if you add additional free parameters, right? You can always match better with more free parameters in your model. But what we're looking for as we transition from two sources to three sources to four sources to five sources is we're looking for that drastic drop in the residual. Okay, so you may be if you imagine a plot, and I should have drawn this, but one source we have a residual here, two sources we have one slightly lower, and then three sources we may drop down here, four sources will come over here and only be slightly lower, five, and so on. So really what you're looking for is that drastic drop, that transition. You're always going to get better assuming more sources, but you're really looking to match, you're really looking for that drastic drop, okay? Well, the Keiki information criteria just takes advantage of that. And it's simply It's just used to determine the number of sources that are present, and our inputs for this are K, which are the number of model parameters, and in our source there's, or in our case there's two per source, a azimuth and a declination angle per source. So if we had, if we assumed one source and that's two parameters, if we assumed two sources, that's four parameters, and so on, okay? N, which is the number of equations involved, and for our particular model, it's the number of microphones times the number of frequencies that we want to process, okay? Remember, we're in the frequency domain here, so we're processing frequency bands. And then it's times two for the real and imaginary parts of each band. And then the residual comes in, which is just the result of our objective function, that magnitude of the residual that we calculated. And this is just the formula. You just plug it in and you chug away, okay? And essentially, when you solve for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we're a little more sophisticated about that. We don't solve for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 every time, okay? We try to be more sophisticated. But essentially, you're going to come up with a cake information criterion number that's lowest at the correct answer, okay? Now, like I already said, by increasing the number of free parameters, you're always going to improve the goodness of fit, right? For your data. But the cake information criterion takes that into account, and it not only rewards the goodness of fit, but it penalizes the number of free parameters that you use. Okay, so that's what this term right here is you're adding in a penalty the more parameters you use to fit the data. As I said, the preferred model, the preferred number sources, is the one that spits out the lowest AIC number. There's an update to this that adds a second order correction for small sample size. So if you have a small number of equations, or you can't process very many frequencies, or maybe you only have a few frequency bins that your detector determined had enough energy in them to process, you throw in this correcting factor for a small sample size. And essentially, when N gets large, it just goes to the standard AIC. So really, you always want to implement this, no matter what. So it handles small sample size, and then if you have a large sample size, it converges to the standard AIC. So that's just a simple way that we can make a decision about how many sources are present. Just some considerations that we take into account with array processing. Like I already stated, that nonlinear unconstrained algorithms or optimization algorithms, they're not typically employed in real-time systems due to the computational burdens. Okay, it takes lots of floating point operations per data window. There's always the potential for divergence. You just go off in la-la land, essentially. And then you also are always fighting the battle of overcoming local minima, because you're wanting to find the global minima, right? But with the optimization, you can always end up in a local minima. So one thing that goes into this, array design is very critical, okay? That's kind of a odd-shaped array when you look at it. It looks kind of like a seventh grade molecule model, right? But that array gives us a very good objective function for the particular signals that we're wanting to look at. It gives us a nice, smooth objective function with, hopefully, and in most cases, no local minima that we can get trapped in. Just like in beamforming, you can have spatial aliasing, where in beamforming, if you spatially alias, it gives you a bad lobe, right? Or side lobes, or maybe a bad beam response, essentially. Well, for us, spatial aliasing gives us a bad objective function, a non-smooth objective function that is cluttered with local minima. So we have to be careful about how we design our array. And then also, observability. We want to get maximum observability at the frequencies we're interested in, which means we want to push the aperture of that array out as far as we can, right? So we can get, essentially, if you think about beamforming terms, you get a narrower beam, right? Well, we want to push that out as far as we can, but yet we don't want to spatially alias. So we have to be careful in designing our array. The approach that we use is what I call quasi-broadband. because we're doing a nonlinear fit over a group of frequencies, where with a beamformer, you're working on a single frequency, right? You can do multiple single frequency solutions, but for us, we take into account, we have a band, say we wanted to process from, I don't know, 5 hertz to 50 hertz or something arbitrary. All that gets fit into our least squares fit, whereas with a beamformer, you're working at a single frequency, and you can do it for multiple frequencies and then do some kind of averaging together or something like that to get a quasi-broadband beamformer. We can do it with this hardware. We can do up to 5 simultaneous sources. Okay, for gunshots, we could have 5 people shooting at exactly the same time from different locations, and we could resolve it and point to them. And another unique thing is that they can have identical spectra. Okay, they don't have to sound different. They can sound exactly alike, and we can still separate them out. And we're doing it for 5 sources up to 5 sources at 13 frames per second. Okay. So, although we pay a penalty computationally and in setup, there are benefits, because these are some things that the competition is not able to do right now. It's simultaneous shots, rapid fire shots like machine guns. These are all things that we're able to do that the others aren't. And that's about all I've got.
So you can do 5 shots, really, 5 shots at 13 frames a second? If one of the sources is rapid firing, that would...
Yeah, we've actually tested against very rapid fire, okay?
But you couldn't do 5 sources doing simultaneous rapid fire, could you?
Yeah, because they're going to fall in different frames, okay, typically.
So when you say rapid fire, the assumption is still one shot.
We could get up to 2 shots in 1 frame, probably, from automatic weapon, maybe.
So how does that influence your optimization, then? Because I
just another source at some later time in the frame.
A frame is actually 256 samples times 6 per each microphone.
Right.
And then we have a 30 sample overlap, like we discussed earlier in the semester.
Right. But when you say 5 sources simultaneously, you could do
5 sources in 1 frame.
Sources at 1.
5 sources in 1 frame. So there could be up to 5 shots in 1
frame.
That's what
I'm saying, right.
Okay. Or there could be, you know, a truck engine and 4 shots, or 4 truck engines and 1 shot. I guess in 1 frame, 5 wavefronts, acoustic wavefronts, crossing the array at 1 time, and we could resolve them out.
You must see the nonlinear optimization from some starting point. Can you talk about that?
I don't know if I know enough about it to talk about that, to be honest with you, because...
I mean, you must do some kind of linearized approximation or something to get a starting point.
Typically, what's going on, say we're mounted on a Humvee, we always have engine noise. So we always know there's a source located here. So we can always start at that point with a source and then just pick some arbitrary location. Maybe we want to spread the others out in a particular way that's optimal for the way that they convert or something. I'm not real sure how VAR does that, to be honest with you.
When the system's first turned on, there's no information, and it just assumes has an elevation of 0, 0. After that, the initial position is always the last detection.
Right, okay.
That's right.
He starts with the last detection, no matter where it was, and that's where we start.
And since we've been very careful with our array design and the objective function is a smooth objective function, it typically doesn't matter where you start from. Because we really don't deal with the problem of local minima, because we've been very careful in how we design things.
So do you know how many steps? So this, like the Newton method, you're basically going to do steps, time increments, or whatever you want.
Iterations.
Do you know how many steps it takes, iterations, to get to convert what you consider?
We typically converge in 3 to 4 iterations.
Yeah, so that's one of the interesting things I found about a lot of signal processing systems is 3 iterations. I don't care what the algorithm is. If the algorithm's good, after three iterations, you get most of your mileage. It's really amazing.
Well, with the Levenberg Markhart, it was slightly more. It was probably closer to 10. In fact, we had to, for real-time operation, we had to limit it to 10 and say, get as good as you can in 10, and that's as far as we're going to let you go because we can't turn the loop. But, and we were typically going to 10 every time.
I'm very impressed you're actually using the Akagi information criteria. We teach it. I've seen it, but I've never seen an application that's actually used it.
It works really well. So Gars had a lot of good luck with using it. And in fact, we've had people ask us, well, we tried to do that. How's that working for you? And all right, I'm going to turn it over to Gerald now. He's got about, I don't know, three or four slides he's going to go through.
All right, guys, good to be here.
Grab some water real quick.
You know, normally you watch these things on video conference, so I know the back of everybody's head from like a very weird angle. Yeah, I know who has good hair days, who has bad hair days. Okay, my name is Gerald Godbold, and I also work with Jeff and Chad. Jeff may not have told you, but Jeff has done his undergraduate and graduate in Mississippi State. Chad has done his undergraduate and graduate all at Ole Miss. Can you tell any difference? See, me, I've done undergraduate at State and graduate at Ole Miss. So maybe I'm kind of a hybrid.
Jeff has better hair.
Does have better
now
hair.
Now we have to throw you out of the classroom. Especially after that football game.
Especially after the football game. Okay. Well, we'll talk about the football game in a minute. So, Jeff mentioned we're going to talk about geolocation. Just real quickly, what is geolocation? Chad's explained to you. Our nice little sensor over here does a great job. Has anybody ever gotten shot at? Like, for real? Ever? One time? Yeah, did you? What was the first thing? Did you say something? Or?
Yeah, I just got shot from the pinball.
From pinball?
Paintball.
From paintball. Okay. Well, I don't think I've ever been shot at in anger. It's the thing with my wife that happened a long time ago. But we got to do some testing a week ago. And I got to ride around in the back of a Humvee on a wide firing range, getting shot at for 3 days in the cold. Say 2 days in the cold. And we say the first thing when you get shot at with live ammunition, first thing you think is, what? Where did that come from? You know, you go, I want to know over there. And this box does a real good job of telling you, like, that way and exactly what time that event happened. But
you were actually in a Humvee,
yeah,
while they're shooting?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this
live ammunition
recommended? Is this standard testing?
There was a safety.
There was a safety ban.
Yeah, I can understand. But
believe me, though, it will give you a new appreciation. They were. It was very interesting.
Especially when that supersonic crack hits the Humvee. It'll give you a very good
The crack is the most amazing thing because it's very loud and it has a distinctive sound. It's like a bullwhip times 10 or even times 100, and it means business. But if you hear it, you know, you're okay because if it hits you, you'll probably never hear it.
So do you hear it? I mean, were you hearing it before the bullet?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, noticeably. And the further out you get, the bigger the time delay. You hear the crack of the whip, and then later on you hear boom. In the distance, it's really remarkable. It's hard to describe it. It's one of those sensory perception things that you just have to kind of do it to be into that. But the box does a great job telling you where that came from. But if you were in a convoy, or you were providing security for a nuclear power plant, or border security, or securing the base in Iraq, odds are if you're trying to deploy somebody to take an action based on that event, you want to know a little bit more precisely than, hey, it's over there somewhere. You want to know where to send somebody or where to return fire. So for that, we need more than one mode. We need another source of information, right? Either, like Jeff explained, either a crack in a bang or a flash in a bang or a flash in a crack or a crack in a crack. You know, we need something else to give us enough information to be able to solve that problem. So one of the novel things that we've done back in the spring was we developed a real simple way to use two of our boxes, which are very inexpensive relatively, to provide that geolocation. In other words, for you to sit at a computer and see a map and see a light flash up where the gunshot took place. Okay, we can do that with two sensors, or three sensors, or four sensors, or you know some number of sensors all communicating with one another on a wireless network. So that's what we're going to talk about. And I hope I can get done in 15 minutes. I'll give them a good shot. Okay, so this is Davis Wade Stadium, and we've had an invasion by our colleagues over in Oxford. And so we want to find a way to defend the stadium from this attack. And this is really not showing up real well. I don't know if you guys can see this or not, but we've got a sensor, and I guess this is the northwest corner of this end zone. And we've got another sensor in, I guess this is the southeast corner of the end zone. And we have detected a shot, I guess this would be the northeast corner of the end zone. Can you guys see that okay? Okay, so you remember what Chad and Jeff explained about what our sensors know? We know within some GPS tolerance where our sensor is located, right? So we have GPS coordinates for both of those. And then we know we have a compass that tells us which way the sensor is pointing relative to the magnetic north, and to a pretty amazing degree of accuracy, but with some error, we can provide a vector, a pointing vector, to where we heard the shot. So how would we go about trying to pinpoint where that point is on a map? Any ideas? Just given that information. What we know where each sensor's at, we know the orientation of the sensor, we know the time of arrival of that acoustic event. We know the speed of sound, which is, I don't know if Chad mentioned, is largely a function of the temperature, so that varies. And then we know our BSS solution. So the first time we mentioned doing this problem, you know, I thought, like 10th grade geometry, this is a law of sines or law of cosines. You remember solving the problem in geometry where you got the White House and the two boats, you're trying to pinpoint the White House. It's exactly that problem, right? Because you know where that's at, you know where that's at. By that, you know the distance of that line. You know that angle, you know that angle. So you can get that point. And in a bet with the law of sines and a calculator, in about 2 minutes, each of you could come up with that answer. And that would probably be a reasonable approach. But what happens when you have this situation? Okay, can you see that? This time, the shot comes at the midfield, at the 50-yard line. Sensor here, sensor there. How does law of sines work for that? It blows up, right? Something goes to infinity. But, you know, a more complicated way of saying it is all of a sudden there's a ton of ambiguity in the solution. You know, you have a vector pointing this way, and you have another vector pointing back in parallel. So how do you resolve where that point is? Geometry doesn't work so well in that case.
But you could also argue in a typical application that person would have infiltrated the perimeter you're defending, so that shouldn't happen. By that time, you're in real trouble.
Well, if you're in a convoy, and you have the sensor at the front of the convoy and the sensor at the back of the convoy, and somebody attacks you, you're in the middle of the convoy. Well, you want to be able to geolocate them and tell somebody near the back of the convoy to take action on them.
Yeah, so, right, they've still sort of infiltrated the...
Yeah. Well, if you're going down the highway, what is your...
Well, if they were off to the side just a little bit, you'd have a non-zero angle.
Yeah, but you've got ambiguity in your barriers, too.
Yeah. So. Okay.
If you're the guy getting shot at, not being able to provide a solution is probably not the best answer for you at that moment. Yeah. Dr. McGillan would probably appreciate it. This is a rank deficient due to low observability, right? That's kind of what that is. Okay. How do we go about doing it? Well, there's one more piece of information that we've got that I mentioned, and Chad's mentioned, and Jeff's mentioned, and that is we know very, very accurately the time of arrival of each of those acoustic events. Right? I mean, we know down to really, really, really accurately when that occurred. So that is another source of information that we can use to solve that problem. Know the time here, we know the time there, and then we know the bearings between them. So all of a sudden we start to construct a solution. I mean, you can almost kind of see how that's going to work. But what I'm going to do next is kind of take our nice little picture of the stadium and convert it over to a Cartesian coordinate system. And this is the same thing. This is for one sensor. So instead of latitude and longitude in a football field, we've now got an XY plot. And again, we use the same small font, so you may not can read this. This is the location of one sensor, A sub J. J is the subscript for each sensor. You remember, we got to have more than one. So A sub 1 will be the first sensor, A sub 2 will be the second sensor. S is where the shot emitted from. Okay, that's what we don't know. That's the point we're looking for. The point that we think the shot came from is this S plus some error. The error is the ambiguity in the measurement. U is a pointing vector that's the BSS solution. It points in that direction. Alright? So the apparent shot location for the J sensor is denoted by this S plus E sub J vector. We have the time that the each sensor received the shot information, and we're going to back into the time that the actual shot was emitted. Okay. C, of course, is the speed of sound, which is around, you may not know, it's around 340 meters a second, but it's really temperature dependent, so that changes on cold days versus hot days. So it's pretty easy, given this description, to write an equation for this position. So it's S plus the E sub J minus the distance, the pointing vector, times the difference in times the speed of sound, and then plus this offset, which is our original sensor position that we know. And then we can solve for this error vector by simply subtracting S back on the right-hand side of the equation. So we have the error vector is equal to the pointing vector times the difference in time times the speed of sound minus the source location minus the pointing vector. Okay. Now, Dr. Picconi's talked a lot about statistical models for random variable parameters. All of these things that we say we measure, how accurately do we really measure, and what are the statistics that govern how well we can measure them? So, for this analysis, we're going to assume that the expectation of our error vector is unbiased. It has a zero mean. And we have some ideas of what the standard deviation variance are. Okay, so we've got some pretty good ideas. But there's also error in things like the GPS locations. All of these things are subject to some error that can be described by parametric models. Okay, in this case, our model is going to be real simple. We've got a zero mean error vector. Okay, so what do we want to do? For a solution in the case where we have multiple sensors and multiple sets of receptions, we want to minimize the length of this error vector. Okay, so the way we do that is take the expression back on the previous slide. The length of the error vector is an E transpose E. Multiply that out, and we take the minimum of that expression for every sensor. Okay, the unknowns in this problem, again, are the shot emission location and the time of emission. So to take that minimization, to make that happen, take the partial derivative with respect to each of the unknowns, just as we've done in a lot of the problems we've done in this class. And so we end up with these two expressions. This is the partial of this expression with respect to the T sub F firing time. This is the partial with respect to the source location. So from that, we have a system of equations with S as an unknown, source location, and T as an unknown, time of emission, and two equations. Okay, we can rewrite that in a block matrix vector form. So we have an identity matrix. I won't go through every parameter, but it's simply an AX equal B problem. Now this is a...
But this is for all the sensors.
Yes, this is for some number J equal to 2 to N. Okay, if J is equal to 1, you have an underdetermined system. This system of equations would have, if J was equal to 1, you would have four equations and two unknowns and four equations.
So you need that. How many, what's the minimum number you need for it to be properly conditioned? Two, right?
Two, right.
And with two, you can get, you can triangulate distance.
Exactly.
But you,
and
you can't
get
triangulate the 3D position.
Yes, so you can. Yeah. S is, all these vectors, S is a 3x3, is a 3 vector.
So with two arrays, you can actually locate like the height.
Oh yeah, because all these are 3, yeah. Let's see, S is a 3 vector, and T sub F is a scalar. So this vector is a 4x1, this is a 4 times J by 4. Okay, and this, of course, is a 4 by 1. So this term is a 4 by 1, and that's a 3 by 1, and that's a scalar. So I didn't expand that out in a way that could perhaps present that the best, but that's the way it works. So a minimum of two sets of information paired together will give you a good solution. Okay, you all recognize the AX equal B. All right, y'all done MATLAB, and you know how MATLAB solves that problem. MATLAB looks at the condition number, this is more or less true, looks at the condition number, and then it kind of picks the best way to go about solving that. The normal equations, as implemented in MATLAB and WinPack and WattPack, are obviously the fastest. Or it can do like a QR decomposition, you probably may have seen that before, or an SVD. But in any case, this is a real small, even if we had like 10 sensors, it's still like a small equation. And for reasonable data, it's very well conditioned, and it's very fast. In fact, like early this morning, couldn't sleep well last night, so I got up and just ran some tests because I didn't remember. For 8 sensors, MATLAB could process the solution in 0.15 milliseconds on average. So that's pretty quick. That's not too bad. Now, if we had 1,000 sensors, you know, that might be a different computational struggle. But if the data, you know, you can think about it, it all pretty well makes sense. I mean, it's all pretty well constrained. And so you can kind of see how that's not too bad of a system for a numerical solver to handle. Where this really messes up, I got time for a quick story. It's like the first time we tried this, real time, is in a test in Chad's backyard. And I've done all these simulations in MATLAB. I'm going to show you some of that just in a second. And everything works great. So the first time we go out and try, all of a sudden it blows up, and I get however MATLAB crashes. You know, the matrix is ill-conditioned, it can't get a solution. I start looking through the data, and why did that happen? Because we had looked at the condition of this matrix many, many times before, and it's always been very well behaved. Well, I picked the wrong report from one of the sensors. So all this data coming in, I picked the wrong two. So all of a sudden, we take a good set of data and try to pair it with a bad set of data. And what this is really doing is in three space trying to find an optimal solution. All of a sudden, there was no good solution for that. And that A matrix all of a sudden became just terrible, and MATLAB crapped out. So, I mean, that's one of the like engineering challenges that I guess I hope to communicate that goes beyond the classroom. Is when you can have things that in your simulated world work real well, if you get out in the real world and all of a sudden they're knobs that can be tweaked that you never thought to tweak. And sometimes no matter what you do, you just can't see those things until you actually get out in the field and have that experience. So it turns out that this entire system hinges on a little bit more complicated problem, and that's kind of an information theory problem, is how do you always pair up the correct sensors, the correct information from the correct sensors to make this work. That's more challenging. But nevertheless, when you get the right set of data, it's really, really easy, and it's really, really fast. So let me show you some stuff we did in MATLAB. This is two sensors 200 meters apart. This is hard to read. I apologize. We have a sensor at 0, 0, and we have a sensor at 200, 0. And then the blue triangle is the emitted source location, and it's at 100, 100. And then the red triangle is the actual return solution. And I know you can't read this, but the mean square error, if you just take like the norm, is 7.4 meters. So that's on a scale of several hundred meters. That's just two sensors worth of information. This is the same simulation, same geometry, run 1,000 times. So this is the distribution in X and Y of that point cloud. So this is 90 meters, this is 110, this is 90, this is 110. So if you kind of include the periphery of the boundaries, it's plus or minus 10 meters in each direction. The third dimension, Dr. Cohen, is solved. I just didn't show it in the plots because it's hard to illustrate. And more often than not, we're always kind of black one down. It's not so often that somebody gets up in the press box and shoots at it. But it would work. I think our elevations are sufficiently accurate for it to work just as well in that case. This is the histogram, and I'm sure most of you can infer. I haven't talked about the statistical models that we use for these parameters because that's could be kind of proprietary, but what do you think you can infer about some of those based on that? I mean, this is just multiple iterations of a bunch of random variables. And so, like, this is the distribution of the mean square error. So you can kind of see what we model. this is three sensors.
Same basic geometry, except this time we added a sensor here. The blue is the emitted point, the red is the solution. They're essentially right on top of one another. Mean square error is 3.8 meters. This is the same 1,000 sample iteration. This time, we're about plus or minus 5 meters in each direction. So we've almost got twice as good, I mean 100% better, just by adding one sensor. So three sensors deployed out at the stadium could do a pretty darn good job of telling you where to shoot back. Not too bad. And again, this is real fast. There is no computational speed difference in calculating two sensors versus eight sensors versus 20 sensors in MATLAB. I mean, this is just not, just meaningless. Again, here's the distribution. Kind of looks the same, except all of a sudden our mean has been shifted. So now our mean error is like 3 meters or so. Okay, here's the hard problem.
Oh, wait. Four sensors.
No.
So what happens?
Four sensors
is
too easy.
Four sensor.
It just gets better.
I'm gonna factor two, or you're gonna have a lot of.
I'm gonna show you. Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna show. This is the hard problem, and you know, yesterday I didn't really have time to fix this. This is the parallel problem. Okay. This is 0, 0. This is 0, 200. This is 10^-4 in Y. So if you plotted this, if the scale was really correct, the emitted point is right in between the two sensors. I apologize for the plot, but that's the problem I showed you before. All of a sudden, look at this. Isn't this cool? I mean, the first time I saw this, I got Chad, or Chad got, you know, I was like, crap, that's really cool, because look, it's 100 meters away in one direction, and it's only like plus or minus 5 in the other. And it's just repeatable, man. It just chugs, and that's like the mean square error of over a bunch of samples of a little less than 2. So it nails it every time. And, you know, I bet it's not, if you did like law of sines or law of cosines, it's not that much slower. it really works real well. I think we have one more slide, and this is the answer to your question. We have two sensors, mean square error, almost 18 meters. Three sensors, mean square error, 10.5, 11-ish. Four sensors, around 10 or so. Out to eight sensors at around 6. So it's got a nice exponential decay. If someone wants to buy...
It's got a bad exponential decay.
Pardon me?
It's got a bad exponential decay.
Oh.
You'd like it to be linear.
If somebody wants to buy more than 8 sensors, I'll be happy to continue the simulation and see where the... If somebody wanted to buy 100 tomorrow, we could work on that. But that's the trend. All right, I think that's the last slide I had. This is a bunch of video. We have like a 3-minute video. You think I have time?
Yeah, sure. We can
show that. Okay. Now, this video has sound. I don't guess there's a way to do this, perhaps other than maybe turning my laptop all the way up where you can hear this. Let me tell you what you're going to see. Jeff is real familiar with the guys out at the Tupelo Airport. And so this was a little video we put together to illustrate how something like this could be used in a real-world scenario. So what you're going to see is a video of our GUI user interface that's done in Google Earth. Okay? So what you're going to see is 6 sensors deployed at the airport facility in Tupelo. And then you're going to see simulated shots occurring on the 6 sensors. You'll see the sensors pop up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You'll also see the video zoom in on each sensor because all of these are connected over a network. So through our Google Earth interface, we can go browse and drill down into each sensor and look at things like operating parameters, like which way is it pointed, are there any faults on the sensor, what's the temperature, and that kind of thing. So this kind of shows all that. So this is a real-world scenario. But all of the data is simulated, but this is actually the software running. This is not like a flash demo. It's actually the real stuff, but there's nobody actually shooting a gun. Okay.
had nice music in here and sound effects and, gosh, and seen it in stereo. Okay, so there's sensor one. It's coming online. This is sensor two and sensor three. Okay, there's sensor six. Now, the airport is about 1K each way. Okay. So six sensors covering that area is very sufficient. So in Google Earth, you can actually drill down into each sensor and pull up status information. And all that's being returned over the network. Okay. Okay, so there's a shot at point one. Again, these are simulated shots, but this is real solutions. So the error cluster that I'm going to zoom in and show you is real. So if you were directing somebody as to where to go to respond to that, you would know pretty close where to send them, right? You could probably even return fire from a remote location at that point. And then we store all of the shot information in the database, so you can actually go back and look what all happened, reconstruct it.
So this is running on a central computer?
Yes,
like
yeah.
1.3 gigahertz?
Oh yeah, this demo ran on my laptop with software that was written in Google Earth and it's linked to MATLAB.
This is actually in real, the same in real time?
Absolutely, yep.
So the response time is very impressive.
Yes. So there's a parallel shot problem, right? That's it. See, I wanted to include advertising in my video, like GoDaddy.com, but Jeff wouldn't let me. But I think that's all I have, Dr. Ferguson.
Well, okay. I really, really appreciate this. This is a superb presentation, much better than I could have done, and really interesting stuff. And I'm glad students get a chance to see that this stuff actually works in real world, in real time, in the real world. Thank you very much.
So that's a wrap. Except for this little thing we call a final exam.